So I'm going to give a talk that I hope will motivate what I think is a new trend in strong field physics, which is looking beyond the single active electron model. And before I do so, I should let you know that right now at the Pulse Institute, we're involved in a lot of different projects. And even just to describe the members of my group and the close collaborators gets to fill a whole page. So this is almost notional. Although the people who were closely involved, the students who are closely involved, I'll be naming as we go along, James Cryan and so forth. We have a large collaboration that reorganizes for different experiments to work in the areas of ultrafast control with high harmonics. That's mostly these guys. And strong fields, that's mostly these guys and these guys. And X-rays, which is everybody. We all get together to work on free electron laser experiments. So before I get started on the subject of multiple electrons, I do want to point out that in our field, in the field of strong field control, coherent quantum control is already a practical tool. It isn't just something that we're studying. It's something that we're using. It's part of our toolbox. Here's an important example from my own group, which is molecular alignment. This is something that's been already discussed in some other talks, but transient impulsive stimulated rotational Raman scattering is an extremely effective way to create coherent rotational wave packets in molecules. And then as those wave packets periodically rephase, you get distributions of molecular bonds that you can use. So in this case, aligned diatomic molecules. And we've used the techniques that we've learned from people like David Tanner for quantum control over the years to really optimize this. So here's a shaped pulse that consists of eight short pulses that are spaced by a magic amount. And the data shows the amount of alignment of an ensemble of nitrogen expectation value of cosine squared theta, where one would be a classically perfect value and 0.3 is not aligned at all. And you can see that we really do very well up here, well above 0.5 in alignment. And then we just use the fact that we have aligned molecules to be able to do experiments in the body frame of the molecule. So among those experiments that we do is high harmonic generation. Also, it's been discussed quite a bit at this meeting. And just to remind you, there's a kind of a paradigm idea in high harmonic generation that it's a process that's driven by field ionization tunneling out of the bound state potential of a system. So this is the highest occupied molecular orbital of nitrogen. You see the electron tunneling out. And then when it returns, it can inelastically rescatter, and the radiation generated from that recombination is the high harmonic generation. So that idea gave rise to this very natural conjecture that particular energies of recombining electrons would experience destructive interference with the shape of this potential, a sort of a corrugated shape of the potential. And so you'd see that as a modulation in the high harmonic spectrum. Some harmonics wouldn't be generated as much. And here's the example. This is from our data, but Itatani was the person, was the lead author on the group that first really pushed this Ottawa, and you can see the high harmonic train here with a nice little dip, which they said that's a structural minimum. So these coherent control ideas that allow us to align molecules allow us to make critical tests of that concept, because with control we can change the orientation of the molecule with respect to the returning wave packet. And what you'd expect if it's a structural minimum is a change in the position of the minimum that depends on the angle. And this red arrow shows where that dip should go as I rotate the molecule with respect to the driving field. And you see that the dip doesn't move. It doesn't follow that. So it right away, and this is so in one afternoon, you can make a critical test. It turns out that although this is a very powerful notion, the one example that was first used is it happens to be not right, at least in our view, according to this result. And in fact, through these means and others, we were able to demonstrate that the real reason, the main reason for the modulation here, is because there are multiple orbitals involved in the harmonic process, and they have different shapes, and therefore turn on more for different orientations. So, you know, this isn't a complete discussion of this project, but it just I want to buoy everybody's spirits that coherent control can be extremely useful and can even just turn into a standard laboratory toolbox tool. We're pushing this now to triatomics, asymmetric top molecules. The high harmonics that you collect are somewhat more difficult to analyze. Nonetheless, we've been working with Tamar Seideman, Todd Martinez, Alejandro Sanz to help sort out that problem. And now we're able to measure how harmonics are generated in even complex molecules like this. Okay, so that's enough of the advertisement. Now on to the main subject, strong laser fields and bound electrons. So if you do the same experiment that I just described, but turn up the laser intensity enough so that field ionization starts generating high harmonics or just generating a lot of electrons, you begin to see beautiful patterns emerging of data in your laboratory. So here's an electron velocity map, for example, and this is just, you know, this is just turnkey, turn-on, run-of-the-mill kind of data. It's just gorgeous stuff, where this has the momentum distribution of electrons that are field ionized. This happens to be an aligned nitrogen molecule. And sure, it does look pretty. And all of these little modulations here correspond to a lot of the important features of the strong field ionization process. Above threshold ionization, Freeman resonances, a whole litany of stuff that you can learn by looking at that data. That's looking at the electrons that come out for a laser that's polarized like this and propagating in this direction. But if I look along this direction at the light that comes out, I see the high harmonic spectra from the same experiment. And again, as I described before, you get to use the modulations on that to understand what's going on too. So the data look really complex. Certainly there's enough to keep a graduate student or postdoc going quite a number of years, understanding all of the aspects of this. I've been working on it for about 25 years. In fact, I chose on this next slide data from three different groups. This is Lynn Van Workum, this is our group, and this is Lou DeMauro. And the reason I chose these data sets was because 25 years ago at Bell Labs, we were all in the same place at the same time, just beginning this field. And it's kind of interesting to see how it's evolved. This is the paradigm of strong field ionization. And it shows that over one laser cycle, you can distort the bound state potential enough to field ionize an electron, which then gets accelerated in the field, re-encounters the potential, and through all kinds of elastic and inelastic processes, you see a number of different related phenomena. Above threshold ionization, this is the electrons coming out at high energies. High harmonic generation, this is the light coming out in the vacuum ultraviolet. And non-sequential double ionization, this is looking at the ions left behind and noticing that sometimes you produce double ionization. And all three of these can be explained very neatly by this picture. So what's wrong with this picture? What's wrong with it is that there's only one electron that ever has to experience the strong laser field in order to see all of this stuff. And in fact, it's been both a boon and a bane in this field that that's true. On the one hand, it means that you can just do hand waving to understand everything. And on the other hand, it means that you never really do get a handle on the electron-electron interaction very much. I mean, I've seen papers that claimed that non-sequential double ionization was looking at the largest electron-electron correlation effect that's ever been observed. And yet, so what is this? This is a single electron is the only one driven by the field, and it just inelastically rescatters. They could have done this with an electron beam in a laboratory. So where's the two electrons? That's the question. And so here's the hypothesis. That is, if we go to not these ground states, but transient states, that in states that are excited, that are moving in some way, that strong field physics may show us distinct changes from the single active electron paradigm. So I want to show, I'm an experimentalist, so I have this idea. I go look for evidence for that. And I'll show you a couple of pieces of evidence. First, a little motivation. Excited molecules are highly dynamic. Electrons are moving around, okay? And Therefore, strong fields get to couple to them in ways that are more easily observed, because after all, we're observing the motion of the electrons anyway. In a rough sense, you might say that's the reason to think that this might be the case. So I'll show you two examples. The first one is strong field interactions with molecules that are undergoing molecular transition. In this case, it'll be a ring opening reaction. And then the second example is strong field interactions with core excited molecules that were placed in the core excited state by an X-ray free electron laser, so that I can keep true to what's been the case for the last 10 years in my career, and that is that I hardly ever give a talk that doesn't at least talk about X-ray free electron lasers at some point. All right, let's look at the ring opening reaction. Here's cyclohexadiene, nice little ring molecule, very easy to work with in the laboratory. You shine UV light on it, and with 50% probability in gas phase, the ring opens. This is great, right? Because we're breaking, not only are we breaking a carbon-carbon bond, but it turns out, if you go look at what's going on here, that all of the double bonds and single bonds in the rest of the ring are reversing their order. So very cool electron motion is going on, very fast. If we look at it energetically, you excite to a state that has a reaction coordinate that corresponds to the ring opening, and it goes through a couple of changes in electronic state by means of conical intersections, which are basically just pathways for non-radiative electron state change. These, I won't talk in detail about conical intersections. Probably people here, if they care about them, they know a lot about them. But they are required because of the number of degrees of freedom in this problem. That is, if there's more than a couple of degrees of freedom in a problem, and here you have 3n minus 6 degrees of freedom, where n is the number of atoms, then there must be a way to avoid an avoided crossing and go through a real crossing in the motion along the Born-Oppenheimer potential energy surfaces. And so you get these intersections. Okay, these intersections are really cool places. They're the places where the electrons are changing their shape fast. So our setup is we induce this transition. It then happens, and of course we're interested in the strong field interaction with this. So we're going to turn on a strong field, 800 nanometer laser focused at 10 to the 14 watts per square centimeter. That's a standard unit in our field. It corresponds to something like 3 volts per angstrom in the peak field. And that will induce field ionization and photofragmentation. And now here's how we analyze this. We look at the photofragmentation patterns. They reveal the state of the ring opening process in a complex but nonetheless unique way. That is, we'll be able to tag patterns as belonging to different states of the ring opening. And look also at the energies of the departing fragments, because those are what tell us what the charge state was on the cluster before it decayed. So it tells us how many electrons came off. So this will be our key that we're seeing some kind of multi-electron process. So it may sound crude, it is, but let's give it a try anyway. So we do the experiment and analyze the results. Here's on a log scale, semi-log scale here, here's a mass fragmentation pattern. You see clearly the different clusters that have only hydrogens, one carbon, two carbons, three carbons, up to the parent cation, which has all the six carbons on it. And you see that when we analyze our data, we just do a little principal component analysis on the fragments that come out, and we discover that more than 90% of our experiment can be described by only three patterns. These patterns may look similar to you, but that's because I plotted it on a log scale. They're actually orthogonal to each other. They're distinct enough that we can assign a fraction of what we see at every time delay with a strong field X to some of this, some of this, some of this. CHD is the parent neutral. CHD plus is the cation. They have distinctly different fragmentation patterns because, of course, they have distinctly different electronic states and also ionization potential. And this is what the hexatriene looks like, at least in the state that we find it, which is the first ring opening stage. All right. if we plot how much of A, B, and C happen as a function of time delay between the strong field and the photoexcitation that starts the ring opening process, we see, first look at the black guy, I think that's black, a nice peak. This is really the cross-correlation between the UV that's doing the photoexciting and the strong field. When they're there at the same time, they can multiphoton excite electrons, and that produces a lot of cations, and so this peaks when the cation peaks. The neutral, of course, is going away, and the third species, which we're labeling hexatrine, actually doesn't turn on right away. It turns on a little later, presumably when a critical conical intersection is passed through or something opens. At any rate, this is the quality of the data that you see. It's a little easier if you plot it in a kind of a Dollitz plot, that is in the plane of the first two principal components, where a single point on this plot corresponds to pure cyclohexadiene that we see at all negative, large negative time delays. And now the two lasers are starting to overlap. Time is moving forward 20 femtoseconds per dot in time delay. And just when the two pulses are overlapped as much as they can possibly be, that's when you have a peak in this direction. This corresponds to the end member in this principal component space that corresponds to the cation, CHD plus. And we don't stay there. We move very fast now, 20 femtoseconds per dot, and eventually end up down here at the finish line when 50% of our sample has returned to cyclohexadiene and the other 50% is in the state that we will call hexatrine. And so that cluster corresponds to the end of the game. So this is a little picture that we call the cat because it's got a couple of cat ears. And, you know, looks interesting. Looks like maybe we're learning something a little bit about strong field fragmentation. Strange problem, though, and that is that there's apparent excess in the hexatrine channel at 200 femtoseconds. That is, if I'm going to have a ring open, why don't I just go from here through the cross-correlation peak that makes the CHD plus, and then back to hexatrine. What's going on? It looks like I'm making more hexatrine, although it isn't quite in the right direction. It's kind of strange. It looks like maybe there's a fourth end member here. At any rate, I bring that up because it relates to the next piece of data that I'll show you, which is not the mass fragmentation pattern, but rather the kinetic energies of release that shows you how charged up this was. So here's an example. This is just looking at a particular fragment. This is the fragment where the molecule breaks in half. So it's a CH3 fragment. CH3 and however many hydrogens. They're all we integrate over over the hydrogens. Okay. This is the kinetic energy of release. And here's T equals zero. So this is the contribution to the cross-correlation peak. You see that you do tend to blow up the molecule and you get a reasonable amount of CH3 fragment and it doesn't have very much kinetic energy, and we expect that that's because we field ionized, basically we've made the cation CHD plus and because of the strong field it's in some collection of excited states where it will dissociate, but dissociates into a charged fragment and a neutral because there's only one extra charge. At a time delay, we start seeing something quite different here. We start seeing a much higher energy peak, much too high in energy to be described by this process, but actually very close to what you would expect from a crude back of the envelope idea to be the Coulomb repulsion energy of a dication that's split into two fragments. So it looks like the strong field, even when it overlaps the UV, isn't really capable of double ionizing CHD very much. You don't really see very much up in this fast channel. But if you wait a little longer, when things are in motion, it gets to be easy. So let me overlay on that the times that you saw in the cat picture. Here's T equals zero. And here's where the max hexatrine signal was. You see it's a little bit after where that fragment peaks up. Now, that's one of the fragments. It was this one here, CH3 fragment. You can look at all the fragments. And you see that they each tell their own individual story, but there is a reasonable trend. This is just the cation. This is C6. And the C6 fragments, they just peak where the cation peaks. Everything else begins to have more or less a turn on a little bit later with a higher charge state. And there's a lot of complexity in here, but the point is that the strong laser field seems to be inducing multiple ionization, not at the beginning, but only during the when the ring opening starts. Okay? So the excess hexatriene that we saw may be something that is correlated with this. So let me, you know, that's the experiment. Now, everything else is just speculation. What are the possible mechanisms that would motivate the next experiment that we should do to try to understand what's going on here? And let me just point out a couple of ideas. Although you know, we now have a whole catalog of different possible ideas, these both look promising. The first one is that there is this phenomenon that is known in the literature called enhanced ionization. Enhanced ionization works like this. If I look at the field ionization threshold for field ionizing a diatomic molecule, I get a certain number. Now, if I move the two atoms, the two ions apart, that number goes down. It gets easier to field ionize when the separation is larger than the internuclear separation. Quite a general phenomenon that's been discussed a lot in everything from, well, certainly calculations have been done in hydrogen, but also in other molecules. It's been documented experimentally. It's got an easy hand-wavy explanation. The idea is that to tunnel, you have to get through a classically forbidden barrier, whose height, of course, depends on the strength of the laser, but whose height is always lower for the uphill in a diatomic. And as the two atoms move farther apart, there is a sort of a magic distance between them where this barrier is the smallest. And that's basically the enhanced ionization idea. Of course, this was not developed to say anything about multiple ionization, but it's just a motivating idea. Another idea that I like very much, because I'm a co-author on this paper, and that's my student, is the idea of quantum resonance rings. And this simply points out that whenever you have a conical intersection, so this is a Born-Oppenheimer potential energy surface, just generic, here's a conical intersection. Whenever you have one, there must be a ring around it where there's a one photon resonance between the upper surface and the lower surface. And these surfaces always correspond to electronic states that have different symmetry. That's absolutely assured. And the reason that I know can say that with such high confidence is that as I change the reaction coordinate, one of these state energies is going up and the other one's going down. That's why they cross. So they can't have the same symmetry. They don't. And therefore, there will generally be a coupling, a dipole coupling between them at the resonance ring. And that's a place where you get to launch electrons from the lower state to the upper state, and maybe that's a way of getting multiple electrons to come out. Well, I'll leave it at that, let you ponder that, and now take you to the last part of this discussion, which is another way to create electrons in motion and see effects. And that's using an X-ray free electron laser. I won't say much about the X-ray free electron laser, except you can see it from outer space, and it's longer than a football field, and it's a billion times brighter than the next brightest source of X-rays anywhere. And it produces very, very short pulses. Now, generally, it produces noisy pulses. The process is stimulated undulator radiation. And because it's a laser that builds up from noise, it looks noisy. It looks like the worst nightmare of a Q-switch YAG laser. But in fact, if you tailor those electron bunches, you can make it so that a good fraction of the time you'll only get a single coherent spike, and the width of that spike tends to be a couple of femtoseconds. So it is a short pulse source if you know how to look for the signature of that in your data. So what do we use this for? Well, the great thing from the point of view of this talk, this idea, X-rays are a fabulous idea. Why? Because they preferentially ionize inner electrons. Here's the ionization cross-section as a function of photon energy from the X-ray handbook. And you have these characteristic edges where the cross-section goes up an order of magnitude. Why? Because it's becoming energetically possible to ionize from a lower level. And at any given energy up above here, 90% of all the ionization is from the lowest bound level. Now, when you excite by ionizing one of these electrons, every other electron in the molecule, well, except for this one, is in an excited state. So this is a multiply excited state of the sort that's very difficult to make any other way. And then it just decays. This shows all the different processes that can happen. I want to focus on this one, Auger. Auger is evaporative cooling of the rest of the electrons. They're very hot when they're all excited. And they cool off through collisions, just like evaporation usually happens. But in this rarefied state space of quantum mechanics, they only have limited states they can go to. And so you get characteristic Auger energies, where one electron takes up all the energy required to drop down and gives it up to another one that comes out. Now, it's true, a lot of other things happen. But let's focus for the moment on this one. This process, by the way, happens very, very fast. This is back of the envelope stuff, so I'll just kind of give you the bottom line. That in our focused X-ray laser at SLAC, the typical rate for photoionizing a typical atom like neon or nitrogen is 1 femtosecond, which means that we'll saturate the ionization. We'll ionize every atom in the beam, and we'll have a lot of core electrons. Furthermore, if we keep the laser on longer than a femtosecond, this will start to recycle, and we'll ionize even more. Okay, so just to recap, core ionization and then Auger relaxation. This leaves you in a dication state. Let's take a look at that dication state. Here are the energy levels calculated by Wetmore and Boyd a long time ago. And here's energy in EV. And you can see this shaded region is the Frank-Condon region. This is the internuclear separation that the nitrogen has when the dication is formed. You see a lot of these potential wells, you end up kind of on the side of the potential well. And you can certainly imagine that you would have a lot of coherent vibration when ionization happens. Of course, a lot depends on how rapid the Auger process is compared to these oscillations back and forth. So let's take a look and see if we're even forming all of those states. So we've done those experiments at LCLS. Here's the Auger spectrum. It's got all these peaks in it, and they all have characteristic angular distributions, which of course I measure because I can align the molecule in the lab frame. I don't even have to mention that anymore. You know that I'm doing that. So here are the angular distributions of these Auger processes, and you can see that they have different symmetries, and they correspond very well to those states that were calculated by Wetmore and Boyd. So we think that we really are populating these states.
Yeah. So if I understand that diagram, the one you just moved on from.
This one.
So the degrees here represent the polarization of the light with respect to the molecular axis.
Yeah, it's these error bars here. You can see them. That's right.
Okay. So you've aligned the molecule in the molecule is aligned in the same direction for all of these figures. These are different probe orientations with respect to
that. That's right. These are different directions that the electron comes off. So now let's see what we can do with a strong field. Again, this is back to strong field physics. Describe the Auger process. By the way, if we only had a strong field, laser field, shining on nitrogen, you certainly do form multiple ions. Mostly you form just a cation. Again, this is a time of flight apparatus where I look at the nitrogens after they've been ionized by the strong laser field. Here's where the dication sits. Here's the nice dication peak. If it dissociates, you get little wings on that peak from the nitrogen atoms with their kinetic energy pushing away from the dication. And here's the doubly ionized atoms coming off. Okay, that's with the laser. If I do this with the X-ray laser, Well, you don't see much cation because Auger process is very efficient. But you see plenty of dication, and you see these nice peaks here. And now the question is whether what we're seeing here in the time of flight spectrum is actually just a time average view of a lot of oscillations that we can now control with a strong laser field. So let's take a look again at the dications. This is from a different publication, but it's the same idea. This is the molecular potential of the dications. And now this LIP, this was a calculation of how these potentials change if I turn on a strong laser field. This is the light-induced potential from the strong laser field distorting the dication. And you see there's plenty of room for tunneling or crossing over the barrier from the states that I produce. Here again, the Frank-Condon region, I'm producing states all up and down here, a broad bandwidth of energies. Some of them I can certainly field ionize and dissociate with the light-induced potential. So do we see that? Let's put both the X-ray and the infrared laser on at the same time and look at the difference between, or the ratio between doing that and just the X-rays by themselves. Okay? And we see that this very deep dip here, the biggest feature, is the dissociation of the dication. And you also see the second biggest feature, a lot of additional doubly charged nitrogens that come from having ionized the dication. Now you have an N2 triple plus, and when it dissociates, you always get a doubly charged atom as one of the two fragments. So it's definitely happening. The question is, can we control it? Can we actually see wave packets? And can we start to do strong field physics? Well, you can actually guess where you should be looking. We expect to see oscillations of the dication states with the various oscillation periods that we should be able to measure. We go in the lab and try to measure it. And at different time delays, we get different dissociation spectra, and it's very messy. And the answer is, right now, it's inconclusive. The problem is that we haven't yet solved the problem of pump probe jitter, the jitter between the strong field laser. We have to control this better. OK. Now, I'm kind of out of time, except for the discussion. But I do want to just show you a couple of other things that involve more than two electrons. I mean, why should we stop with two electrons once we have strong field X-rays? We can photoionize Auger, photoionize Auger, photoionize Auger. We can do this all the way down and make bare atoms. In fact, here's the first experiment that Linda Young led at LCLS, made neon 10 plus, took all of the electrons off neon. And at different energies, it's showing how you collect all the electrons that you can possibly collect that are energetically allowed for ionization. So certainly there's room here for multiple electron work. And we can even see double core holes where we completely clean out the 1s shell by photoionizing twice before Auger even happens. And the way we can see that is two ways. First, because it makes hollow atoms that can't absorb any more radiation. So here's an experiment where we tried to keep the pulse energy the same and shorten the pulse duration from a long pulse to a really short pulse. And the idea was, with a really short pulse, we're now under the Auger lifetime. So once we clean out the first two electrons from the nitrogen, the game is over until Auger relaxation. We aren't going to ionize anymore. And so it should clamp the high charge states. And that's the green line. And you see it does. The high charge states in the time of flight spectrum turn off when the pulse gets short. So we're really making a lot of hollow atoms. We can also look at the Auger relaxation from those, since here's the Auger I was showing you before, that nice complicated Auger spectrum. Way up here at higher energy, you see the spectrum of the double core vacancy relaxation. Okay. Now, a big challenge to look at strong laser fields and how they affect these, but it's certainly something that's within the realm of possibility. So this is the conclusion slide. What I maintain is that our hypothesis still looks viable, that X-ray-induced core holes and transient states in molecules do seem to be new paths to driven multi-electron dynamics. Strong field lasers can actually probe the fastest timescales that we see in molecules, And that's one of the reasons that they're very interesting to us. And these, through these effects like hollow atoms and the Auger spectra, these are new opportunities to study these kinds of strong field processes. Thanks very much for your attention.
Could you elaborate a little bit about the connection between this X-ray phenomena and maybe some coherent control or optimal control ideas?
You mean feedback control ideas?
For instance?
Yeah. You know, I wish I could, in a sense. What we're interested in doing is things that are the atomic analog of changing a branching ratio in a molecule. Now, changing a branching ratio in a molecule turned out to be tinker toys, simple compared to this, because the timescales are so much faster. And so I can tell you some of the ideas we have about control knobs that we might be able to develop that would allow us to do things that are more like optimal control experiments. One of the things that we can now do as a result of a lot of work on the X-ray laser is make multiple laser pulses. We can do that in two different ways. We can either make an electron bunch that actually lasers twice and control the spacing between those. We've done those experiments, in fact, already. They already look, I didn't put the data up here because my collaborators would be upset if I did, but in fact, those experiments are already happening, and there are things to see. Or we can use a split and delay, which means you take the laser beam and you divide it in half by phase front division, a split mirror, and delay one part with respect to the other. And that gives you completely jitter-free, very reliable pulse-pulse spacing and pulse-pulse control. So this is the first control knob that we have. Now, ultimately, would I like to have full pulse-shaping control like we have in the visible and the infrared? Sure. But you know, that's and in fact, I could talk about a technique called echo, which in principle could do that because it's a way of translating a shaped optical field into a shaped X-ray field. But we're very far away technologically from being able to implement that. So it'll happen, but not soon.
It's fascinating getting into this regime. I think it really does open a great deal of doors. One question that I wonder about in terms of measurement is, to what extent, since you're sort of essentially making a single particle type of measurement, that is radiation from a dipole, to what extent is understanding about multi-electron correlations then determined by whatever models you use for that source? And as a corollary, do you think there are ways to make direct measurements of correlations?
The second part first, because I think it's the more important part of the two-part question. Are there ways to make direct measurements on correlations? Yes, of course, there certainly are. We haven't implemented them ourselves, but I think other people are beginning to. You can, for example, even do a full Coltrane's experiment at a free electron laser, although it's painful. But even if you don't go all the way to that, you can begin to look at correlations, fragment correlations in energy and momentum, and also in fragment type identity, using the techniques that were developed by Franzinski for strong laser fields 20 years ago, and they will work. So certainly there will be experimental tools that allow you to look at particle-particle correlations. A bigger problem is the ensemble problem. The cross-section for doing anything is low, but the flux is high, so you can end up fairly reliably ionizing one molecule if you put it in there. So in principle, you could do a real Coltrane's experiment where you make sure that you have one and only one, not more than one, particle, and so all the fragments are coming from the same particle. It's just the next level of difficulty. Okay. Back to the first part of your question, in lieu of that, of course, all we're measuring, all we can measure are properties of the ensemble and fluctuations in the properties of the ensemble. We can't ever say something about a single member, what a single member was doing. So that's a, you know, that may be a limitation. It's not a limitation in the particular experiments I was looking at here, but I think I'm doing much cruder stuff than one can do in the regime of single atom, single photon type experiments.
Question about, so you about this light induced potentials, when you have very practical time scale about 10 femtoseconds, so how do you measure this method, or how you plan to measure?
Well, for 10 femtoseconds is not 3 femtoseconds, and so it's still possible to talk about things like light-induced potentials. I'm not exactly sure where your question is going, because what we measure, of course, is dissociation momentum. We can measure the direction and the energy and the identity in terms of charge state and that kind of thing of all of the fragments.
So in some sense, you can drag the wavefront.
Well, for example, if we wanted to probe something that we thought, if we wanted to look for bond softening, well, that's just looking at the energy of the spectrum of the dissociating fragments, and certainly we can do that.
And second question I have about on the first slide when you just start explaining the reopening, ionization, and so forth. Do you have some coherence as well? So I just
between the pump and the probe? What do you mean?
The product actually, this is after you break the molecule. Then break the ion, you have ions. And it seems to me that
It's certainly a coherent process, but we're not measuring. You're wondering, do you have some coherence between the fragment that went to the right? Well, I mean, the way I described it was a completely coherent process, but getting a handle on using that for something, I don't know. I mean, that's not typically been how we thought about these experiments. I think this goes to a question that David was asking before, you know, in the morning, which is, you know, when if you look at above threshold ionization, you do this with an electron spectrometer. Well, your electron spectrometer is not truly measuring an energy; it's actually measuring a momentum, and you're converting it to an energy in your computer, because it has a finite angular size and it's measuring a time of flight or something like that, and so you really don't get the opportunity to look at interference that is going on the entire energy shell. You're only, the collapse that's happening is collapsed to a particular angle. So.
We have one more.
Then we have to move on. We have to. It's a mid-picture question, so I think maybe it's better for even preserve it for. So where do you see? I'm not really an expert in these things, but I sort of wonder where do you see this field is going. So what's like, kind of, you know, what are the big kind of questions we hope to kind of address with that, or you know, what are the maybe as applications, What do you think? Where would you like to be like in 20 years?
Well, you asked two quite distinct questions. The question about the big picture question about the about where the field is going scientifically is that we're really trying to understand how we can test and control many-body quantum mechanics, not just single-body quantum mechanics. That's the scientific part. Application? I only have one answer for that.
Is that true? Because well, we're completely like, you know, blast these things Maybe two bodies, okay.
Absolutely, there's a hope. Absolutely, I have a lot of faith that in the future, what we'll be looking at will be just as crude as 1960s lasers look to us now. And this will get much better. There is so much room for improvement here. This will get better. The other question about applications, whenever I get asked that question, I only have one answer: imaging. The application is imaging, of imaging of nanoscale material, and we can go on at great length about why that's an extremely important grand challenge application, but it is.
But those are ultra-fast dynamics using multi-dimensional spectroscopy, is that you're really following a coupled electron nuclei through these conical intersections. I mean, there is another, there's one more, at least one more time scale and length scale of electronic dynamics that yet to be uncovered.
Absolutely, that's right. It's happening inside the conical intersection interaction.
It's imaging is even despite the fact that you sort of break these things and, you know, do bad things. Right?
The great thing about the nanoscale is that first of all, you do break the things, but you get a lot of information while it's breaking. You can get enough information that the fact that it gets broken doesn't matter because you can make more because they're cheap. But the thing about the great thing about the nanoscale is that it's so important in physics and chemistry. So much of what happens in the macro world depends on the shape of things and also dynamics, but the shape particularly of things in the micro world. And so let me just give you the example of protein crystallography. Oh, it's fantastically sophisticated now. The protein data bank is filling at a tremendous rate. We're learning all kinds of things about the average structure of proteins. It's the only thing you ever find out in a crystal. If you get to the position where you can begin to collect data on an individual protein that is interrogated by 10 to the 12 X-ray photons, you can start to see something about the difference between proteins which are functionally identical but aren't perfectly identical. You only thought they were because you were collecting the information in a protein crystal. So this is a vast and important field.
How far are the Sphinx? How far in the future are the Sphinx?
It depends on the size. For things that are on the order of slightly submicron, 100 nanometers, we can do it now. And pushing down towards 10 nanometers, and there's a kind of a holy grail 3 nanometers thing, But that will we be able to do if the kind of structure that you need to obtain is at the 3 angstrom level, that's the most challenging, and I think that's a long way off. But mostly that's not the case. That's usually not what you care about, particularly when you're looking at these differences between nominally identical species.
Okay. Thank you.